This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. If you picture the periodic table, got that in your mind, you know it's in the upper left corner, and it fits in that stair step of nonmetals. But 80 years ago, a pair of researchers theorized that you could turn hydrogen, the gas, into a solid metal. And since then, scientists have been trying all sorts of ways of creating metallic hydrogen. They've zapped it, fired lasers at it, they have squeezed it. And now, drumroll please, a group claims to have created shiny metallic hydrogen by squishing it really, really hard between two diamonds. Their study was published last month in the journal Science. So why are scientists so interested in turning hydrogen into a metal? What could you use it for? And can we really create it? Did they really create it? Isaac Silvera is an author on that study in Science. He's also a professor of physics at Harvard University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you're very welcome. As a physicist, why for so many years are people interested in metallic hydrogen? What's it for? What do you do with it? What can it tell us about physics that we don't understand yet?
Well, first of all, hydrogen is the most fundamental, simplest atom in the periodic table, as you mentioned. It's got a single proton and an electron. And if you take these and put them together, they actually form a bond and form a molecule. But the hydrogen atom itself was studied over a century ago by Niels Bohr, and that brought in the ideas of quantum mechanics. So it's very, very simple and very fundamental. The molecule itself is a very fundamental, simple molecule with two protons and two electrons. And the electrons are between the protons and hold the protons together to form this very small molecule. If you now take that gas of hydrogen and cool it down to 14 degrees absolute, so absolute temperature scale is a scale that's zero, you can't get lower than zero, and I'm talking about Kelvin,
right,
on the
right.
centigrade
so
scale.
You cool it really down, what happens to it?
It becomes a solid. First it's a liquid, then it's a solid. And then you take that and you start compressing it. So when you start out at very low pressure, the two atoms in a molecule are very close together, and the molecules themselves are very, very far apart. They're about six times farther apart than the atoms are in the molecule. And as you press it together, the molecules get closer and closer, and finally they get so close that a proton in one molecule can't decide, should I stay bonded to this other one, or should I bond with my neighbor? And they solve some kind of an equation. You know, they can do the calculation.
Well, can you press it hard enough to make it? From what you've said, you've pressed it together hard enough between these two diamond anvils, so to speak, that you've actually created metallic form.
Yeah, we've pressed it to just under 5 million atmospheres of pressure. 5 million. Bars. A bar in an atmosphere is about the same. But but what happens is when you get them really close, the molecules dissociate and you form an atomic solid. And now the electrons are free to run through the system. They no longer hold the molecules together, and it's a metal.
Does it have all the properties of a metal, what you've done?
Well, so far it has. What we have measured to show that it's a metal is you measure the reflection. It's not enough to measure reflection at one wavelength or one color of light, but we measured from the green, blue, red, and into the infrared. And we find exactly the behavior that you would expect for a metal.
Well, a metal's supposed to be a good conductor, too. Have you run electricity through it to see that, you know, it's a good conductor? Those sorts of things.
That's right. The most rigorous test to show that material is a metal is to show that its electrical conductivity remains finite in the limit that the temperature goes to zero. And we've studied this at low temperature, at liquid nitrogen and liquid helium temperatures. That's 80 degrees and about 5 degrees in temperature.
Now, there are some critics that point out that they don't think you have proved it enough. And I understand you're willing to send this out for further testing. Is that right?
We're not going to send it out. We're going to take it.
I wouldn't trust it either.
We're going to measure, do the measurements ourselves. But it really is, it's sufficient to show reflection. Reflection comes from high frequency electromagnetic waves, and light is an electromagnetic wave. And that makes the electrons respond. They move back and forth, and they reflect the light. So we're actually measuring the very high frequency electrical conductivity. But what you really would like to do is measure the DC conductivity,
right,
where you put a voltage on it and measure a current going through it.
So it's still under pressure now? I understand. What if you just open up the tank and let it go? Would it still stay there as a metal?
So it's not a tank. It's a really small sample. It's smaller than the cross section of a hair on your head, and about 1 micron. A micron's about there are 1,000 microns in a millimeter. About a micron thick, something like that. So it's a small sample, and it's been predicted. I don't know if it's true, and you have to show these things experimentally. But it's been predicted that hydrogen might be metastable. That means that if you get it up to the high pressure, it becomes a metal, and then you release the pressure, it will stay in the form of a metal. It will stay metallic. And if that happens, that would be terrific. That would be
Who's going to unscrew it from there and try that out? Are you going to do that?
Myself and my postdoc, I have a terrific postdoc, Ranga Diaz, and mm-hmm. we've worked on this together, and we'll do it together.
Yeah.
Perhaps pray a little and maybe have something to settle our hands, a little drink to have settle our hands as we turn it down.
But you're confident. So you don't know what's going to happen when you open up the vices.
No. There are other materials that are metastable, and I'll give you a well-known one, diamond. If you take carbon, graphite, and compress it up to about 50,000 atmospheres and heat it up, the carbon turns into diamond. You take the pressure and the temperature off, and you still have diamond. But if you take that diamond and put it in an oven and heat it up to about 1,500 degrees Kelvin, you're going to have a carbon ring instead of a diamond ring.
It's going to go back to carbon.
It'll convert back to the lowest energy state, yes.
I never saw Superman do that with the diamond.
Yeah, but that's what metastability is.
So what is so great about if you could have metallic hydrogen? What are the wonderful things you could do with it?
Well, the first thing that is interesting is that it has been predicted to be a high temperature, possibly room temperature or higher, superconductor. A superconductor is a metal that conducts electricity without dissipation. So we can test for that under these very high pressures. It's a challenging experiment, and what we'll do is put electrical leads into our sample. And that's not going to happen this time because you have to do it before you pressurize the sample and then measure its conductivity. But imagine that it's metastable. You take the pressure off and it stays in the metallic phase. If you could now develop a technique to scale it up, that is, make lots of it, and I've got ideas on how to do that, then you could make electrical wires out of it. And currently, just an example of an application is that in our electrical power grid, we lose perhaps 15% of the energy to dissipation in the wires. The wires are copper, but they have resistance. And so you just dissipate, you're heating the wires when electricity goes through it. But if they were superconducting wires, you would have no loss, no dissipation in the system. So that would be a great advent.
Mm-hmm.
You could make superconducting magnets. So superconducting magnets are used. A well-known application is magnetic resonance imaging, MRI. You could make superconducting magnets that don't have to be cooled. The current ones have to be cooled with liquid helium, which is, you know,
it's in short supply.
We do it all the time, but it's challenging.
Supply.
But you wouldn't have to have helium, and you could have these magnets any place in the world, places where they didn't have helium.
So okay. how long before you can scale this up and actually prove, I guess, by scaling it up? Can anybody do this? Do you have a special technique that no one else can do? Or do you know how to do this?
We have gotten the highest pressure that anyone has ever gotten on hydrogen to convert it into a metal. And we used a lot of special processes and techniques that we've developed over the years. Mm-hmm. And it worked. We got to these super high pressures. Other people have been trying it, and I hear complaints and whining, our diamonds always break. Why aren't yours? Well, in our paper published, we tell exactly what we've done to get these pressures. And people can copy that if they want. And I'll even help them if they want to come over here to Cambridge, Mass. And, you know, we can get them into our clean room and get them access to the facilities that we use to create special diamonds. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, we're waiting to see when you actually start scaling this up. And we send us a little piece of that, you know, liquid, hydrogen for us to look at.
Where are you located?
We're in New York. We're not too far. We're
York.
A little Amtrak ride. Yeah. You can bring it right down here.
Come on over here, and we'll show you metallic hydrogen.
I was just in
Cambridge. It's going to be around.
I was just in Cambridge earlier in the week. If I had known, I would have stopped. I would have stopped by.
Yeah.
I was at MIT and Harvard. You know, MIT, Harvard. It would have been a little tough to get up. Thank you, Dr. Silvera. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Isaac Silvera, author of that study in science, professor of physics at Harvard University. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about free public Wi-Fi hotspots. We're looking at how a group in Pittsburgh is crowdsourcing their own free public network, and maybe you can do it in your town. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Here in New York, Wi-Fi kiosks are popping up on the streets where they used to be lined with phone booths. I'm sure you have your own kiosks where you live, and there are more parks and public spaces getting linked up. But not every city or neighborhood has the resources for that. In Pittsburgh, my next guest is connecting the wireless broadband already there into a type of do-it-yourself public Wi-Fi. It's something called a mesh network. And here to tell us about that and what he's doing is Adam Longwill, Executive Director of MetaMesh Wireless Communities in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's nice to be with you.
So how is a mesh network different that you're putting together? I know you started this 5 years ago. How is it different from the Wi-Fi we have now?
That's a good question. It's much different. It's important to understand that the internet is set up kind of like a Christmas tree, where you have relatively few big routers from big ISPs at the top, and most of us are hanging out at the bottom of that hierarchical tree of routers. A mesh network is different in that it allows for those smaller routers to route traffic instead of handing it off up the tree to the bigger ISPs to route it back down the tree to someone who might be across the world or across the street.
So are you taking the routers that we all have outside? How do you create the mesh network, I guess, is what I'm asking.
We used to take many off-the-shelf routers and just put them in watertight cases and put them outside. Unfortunately, in 2014, the FCC changed some rules for manufacturers to increase insurances that the routers that they manufactured weren't used in ways that broke certain regulations. So we've had to go to China, and we now build our own waterproof boxes and put these small routers about the size of a credit card in these boxes and attach an antenna to them and just attach them to your facade and connect them to a power source and your internet access if you're willing to donate it.
Oh, so that's the key. I have to donate a share of my home internet access into the mesh so everybody can use it?
Yes, that's right. The problem with existing public Wi-Fi models is that they're very top heavy. You have to spend a lot of money up front, and there's a high maintenance fee. You have to pay for dedicated bandwidth. You have to have an IT company monitoring these things every month. And that causes a lot of public Wi-Fi networks to fail, because after 2 years, the money is dried up. With our model, you can put up these very inexpensive devices. We sell them online for $75 a piece. And you basically just share your existing bandwidth, and it's really no cost to you. There's no recurring fees. We don't charge anything beyond the hardware and the installation.
Mm-hmm. So people then have to chip in their own money to become part of this mesh network by buying those routers, those special routers.
Yes, they can purchase these routers from us, although we have instructions on our website, metamesh.org, on how to build, how to configure routers yourself. We were very insistent at the beginning that we didn't want to use proprietary hardware or lock people into, you know, buying from us. We're a nonprofit after all. And we wanted people to be able to join the network without having to go through us. It's this idea of decentralization, just like we have in the network itself, decentralized routing. Well, we want to decentralize ownership and who controls the ability to get on the network. So anyone can get a router and configure it themselves and put it up.
So there's no fee then. Once you're part of the mesh network, you don't have to pay a fee to stay
on. Once you're part of the mesh network, there's no fee, no.
But you're hoping people will buy enough routers themselves to contribute to the maintenance and expansion of this community of routers.
Well, purchasing routers from us is just one way that we make money. We're mainly concerned with educating communities, teaching them how to build these networks themselves. What we do is usually we do a crowdfunding campaign or write a grant and get a grant from a Google or a grant funder locally, a grant maker locally, and we will go into the communities that we are targeting, teach people about networking, wireless, radio, all those things, and then teach them how to install these wireless routers and help them install mm-hmm. them so that, again, we decentralize who controls the network. If we can empower a community to build the network themselves, we can put money on that it'll last beyond our involvement in it.
Now, I know there are cable companies that have their own hotspots in cities that... If you're a subscriber, you can get a hotspot. You can use their hotspot anywhere. Are you getting any pushback from these people who are saying you're taking our business away from us?
We haven't had any pushback from them, and ISPs are certainly not our enemies, despite what you might think. It's important that we have ISPs to connect people around the world. It would be basically impossible to build a mesh network or a small hop network that would encircle the entire world 200 feet at a time. We need ISPs, but we think that there is an alternative way of building connectivity in our own local areas. So we haven't had any pushback from ISPs. We're not in the business of insisting that people break their contracts or go against their contracts with their existing ISPs if their ISP does not allow bandwidth sharing. Certain contracts do allow it, and for those, we seek out those people who have those type of contracts. And we ask that they share their bandwidth. Mm-hmm. We're also in the process of getting our own bandwidth. We have actually just hooked up with a fiber optic provider in the state of Pennsylvania, and they are graciously donating 500 megabit connection of fiber optic capacity that we're going to pump into our mesh network.
Mm-hmm. I have a tweet coming from C.S. Lannan who says, how do you contribute to the mesh network without compromising your own encryption network security?
It's a great question and one that we've had to face very early on. What we do is we have firewall rules built into each of the routers that prevents someone, as we say, on the mesh, someone on the public side of the network, from accessing computers and computers, IP addresses on your private network. So there's a set of private IP ranges that are commonly used, such as 192.168.1.0, et cetera. And we basically just create a rule that says, hey, if someone on in the public is trying to access a 192.168 whatever IP address, just drop the packet. So there's it never even that packet never even makes it onto the Ethernet, never even gets inside the owner's home network.
So if someone outside of Pittsburgh wants to start their own mesh network in their own city, how should they go about starting that, getting involved?
We have provided some documentation on how to configure these routers. We, of course, if you're not technical at all, you are welcome to give us a call or go to metamesh.org and just buy one of these routers. We can ship them anywhere. I just had a conversation with my new friends up in Kivalina, Alaska, so hello to them, yesterday, who are very interested in setting up a mesh network for their small town. We also have instructions for multiple types of routers that you can find on metamesh.org.
All right, Adam, thank you very much for taking time to explain that to us. Sounds kind of exciting. Adam Longwell is Executive Director of MetaMesh Wireless Communities in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Thanks.
As a kid, you probably had a picture book showing a frog. Right, a frog slurping up a fly. Frogs eat flies and insects, and it's one of those facts that you don't remember learning, but you always knew that, right? But if you sit down and think about it, it starts to make a little less sense. Like this, how can the flat surface of a frog's tongue grip and hold onto a flying insect? It's flat. My next guest found out that the secret is in the saliva. Alexis Noel is a PhD candidate in mechanical engineering at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi there. Are you, Alexis, are
Hi,
you there?
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh,
Hello?
You're welcome. Can you hear me? Hello, Alexis.
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, good.
You hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
We're doing it. We're doing a telephone commercial. let's talk about your study. Your study looks at frog tongues, and your last study looked at cat tongues. You're interested in animal tongues as an engineer. What's the connection here?
Yes. In my lab, we study a lot of interesting things. So I studied frog tongues for about 3 years. I'm currently studying cat tongues, really looking at how do you grab things with very soft, squishy surfaces. That's really the crux of my research.
Mm-hmm. And you found that the saliva is sort of the glue that holds it all together.
That is true, yeah. The frog has a super soft tongue, almost 10 times softer than a human tongue, and it uses this very sticky fluid that's kind of infused within the tissue. And you can kind of imagine it's like the snot within your nose, even thicker than honey. It's all very disgusting.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that I didn't realize the tongue is 10 times softer than a human tongue. And it's about, I understand, the same consistency as brain tissue?
That's correct. We also tested brain tissue. It kind of reminds me of when you have a piece of chewing gum that you chew just a little too long and you pull it out of your mouth. That's kind of what a frog tongue feels like.
Have you, you know, I don't want to get too personal here, but do you actually go about feeling tongues of frogs?
I had to do a lot of that during the past 3 years, yes.
Now, I understand you say the key to the stickiness is that the saliva is reversible. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's correct. That was probably the most fascinating part of this whole study. We actually scraped about 15 frog tongues to get a sample large enough to test, because you need about a fifth of a teaspoon of fluid to test in a rheometer. And a rheometer tells you basic fluid properties, things like viscosity. So we scraped all these frog tongues and put the saliva in there, and what we found was that the frog saliva is actually a shear thinning fluid, meaning that viscosity can change based on the shear rate. And this is actually very similar to ketchup. And I know everybody's dealt with ketchup at some point, maybe not frog saliva. You know, if you turn a ketchup bottle upside down, it's very difficult for the ketchup to flow out. But if you smack the bottom, the ketchup flows. Well, that's because you're imparting shear stresses and a shear rate within the fluid, so the viscosity actually drops. So the similar things are happening with frog saliva when it hits on the insect. When the tongue hits, the saliva actually becomes very liquidy and water-like, and it'll penetrate all of the cracks in the insect. And when the tongue comes back into the mouth, the saliva hardens up and becomes more viscous than honey. and it maintains very high grip on the insect.
Wow. How fast does the tongue need to be traveling to create this, just the right amount of force on the saliva?
Well, the tongue... So when the tongue goes out of the frog mouth, it travels at about 9 miles per hour, or about 4 meters per second. So it's traveling pretty fast relative to the frog. And so that's how fast it impacts the insect. And when it pulls back, the acceleration at which it pulls the insect back into his mouth is about four times the acceleration astronauts feel when they go into space. So it's about 12 Gs.
Wow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Lexis Noel, a PhD candidate. She's a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech.
That's great.
And a hell of an engineer, right? sorry, I can never stop myself when I have somebody from Georgia Tech. Huh? Let's take this one step further. The frog has caught the insect. It's whipped it back into its mouth at four times the speed of an astronaut in G-forces. It's got it in its mouth. How does it get the insect off the tongue if it's so stuck to it?
Well, I think that's one of my favorite parts of the study. So that was the question that bugged us. For a very long time was how does the insect get off of the sticky tongue once it's inside the mouth? And so we observed these frogs using high-speed videography equipment. We observed them actually swallowing, and what we noticed was that the eyeballs actually go into their skull and into their mouth cavity and push on the insect inside of their mouth. And so it's that pushing motion from the eyeballs that actually causes the insect to slide off the tongue and into the throat.
Now, we've been doing this show over 25 years, and I think that is the most unusual explanation I've ever heard for a natural phenomenon. The eyeballs push,
That's correct.
Push the insect off the tongue.
That's correct, yes. If you see, frogs are known to have these big bulbous eyeballs on the surface of their skull, and they just completely drop into their skull, and you don't see them.
As a scientist, how do you discover that?
Well, people have known, a lot of biologists have known, that frogs use their eyeballs when they swallow. Many thought that it was just a reaction mechanism. But when we looked at the videos and we actually saw some X-ray videography of insects inside of the frog's mouth, and we saw the insect slide right off of the tongue.
Wow. Now you have studied cat's tongues and now frog tongues.
Yes.
What tongue is next, if I might ask?
What tongue is next? Well, that's a great question. We actually, in addition to the cat research, we actually got a tiger tongue at the local zoo. There was a tiger that recently died, and so we've been able to compare a tiger tongue next to a house cat tongue, and
wow,
we're making some amazing discoveries that the spines on the tiger tongue are actually the exact same size and shape as the house cat, just with more of them. So
wow,
that's been fun. But the next research topic is going to be earwax.
You got me. You got me on this one. Not with the tongue, though, is it? Earwax? Tell me.
not with the tongue. Yes.
What do you want to know about earwax?
Well, we're looking into how earwax is actually a very efficient dust collector within the inner ear. And it actually creates these web-like effects within the ear canal, captures dust, and then falls out of the ear by crumbling when there's enough dust in the earwax. So we're looking at novel applications for dust collection systems with air filtration.
Wow. Alexis, will you promise to come back when you do the study on earwax?
Absolutely.
We can't. Wow, it's going to be great. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We didn't get to talk about gecko tongues and how they use their tongue to clean their eyeballs, but maybe we'll save that for the next one. Alexis Noel is a PhD candidate in mechanical engineering at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. We're going to take a break. A Japanese research team thinks they've solved the mystery of oxygen on the moon. Did you know there was a mystery of oxygen on the moon? It'll give you something to talk about tonight. Where did it come from? Stay tuned. We'll talk about it after this break. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're now going to move from a frog, from frog tongues, which I'm trying to get over, to something very serious. And that is sensing that science and evidence-based research is under attack. The science community and people who care about science and society are organizing. Inspired by the Women's March in January, plans are underway to take to the streets of Washington by the thousands. It's called the March for Science, and it already has over 300,000 Twitter followers. The march will be in Washington, D.C., if I have a calendar. It's going to be on Earth Day, Saturday, April 22nd, to advocate for, quote, open, inclusive, and accessible science. Dr. Carolyn Weinberg is a science writer whose previous work was in public health and medical research. She is one of the organizers, and she's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday. How did this get? It seemed like to come out of nowhere, almost.
It did kind of come out of nowhere. What actually happened was, my kind of one of the co-organizers with me, a guy named Jonathan Berman, was talking about it on Reddit about a march, and he bought a URL, the Scientist March on Washington, which was the original name, and got a Twitter handle and got a Facebook, and it was just kind of sitting. He had like 10 Twitter followers. And I had a similar idea for a march and figured we couldn't be the only one. I couldn't be the only one, so I went on Twitter. And then I eventually got connected to him, and our thread got retweeted a bunch of times. And in like 10 hours, there were 30,000 Twitter followers, and it just kind of exploded from there.
Mm-hmm. And how many people are you expecting to show up?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, there's a million followers on Facebook. We don't really expect that many people to show up. But, you know, who knows? But what's really encouraging is that DC is now a small part of a global movement. There are people who are going to be joining us from literally all over the world. I just got an email from someone who wants to have a march in Panama. And you know, they're happening in Norway and Australia and obviously throughout the U.S. So it's really encouraging that, you know, I don't know how big it's going to be on a global scale, but that it's expanded far past D.C.
Mm-hmm. And this is, people have been mistakenly calling it a scientists' march.
So, I mean, it's
not just for scientists.
No, it was originally called the scientists' march.
Yes.
But maybe like 10 hours after after it kind of came out as that, it was changed to the March for Science, just because it isn't just about scientists. It's about science enthusiasts and anyone who believes that science, you know, needs to be celebrated and championed.
And so what do you hope that comes out of this march? Is there a point to it?
Yes. We hope there's a point to it.
Yeah.
I think our ultimate goal, well, so the march itself, we hope, is just going to kind of encourage politicians and people watching to understand that people really do care about science and think that that evidence-based policy should exist in the government. They should pay attention to science. And so that's really important to us. And then what our kind of ultimate goal with it is to advocate for, you know, policy change. We think that science needs to be part of government platforms. But what we really want to focus on is education and getting researchers out of the lab and into a public sphere and trying to help people to understand what's so important about their research and how it affects their daily lives. Because we think that doing that and helping people get invested in the research that's happening will help them to care about, you know, about the government funding science and listening to scientific research. And, mm-hmm. you know, we think it all ties back to education.
People saw the Women's March and said, that's a great idea for science to be involved in that kind of march? Was that one of the catalysts for this?
I can't speak for John or for Valerie, who's the other co-organizer, or for really the other kind mm-hmm. of probably thousands of people who had the idea for a march and just, you know, were waiting for someone to start it.
The great
Women's
success.
March.
The
Sorry,
Women's March. Yeah, it was a great success.
March. But I don't think that any of us really would have had the idea to do something like a march like this if that hadn't happened. And I certainly don't think, like, when we initially planned the march in D.C., we weren't thinking about how it would expand.
Right.
And it was probably, the idea had probably been out there for like 2 hours before we started getting emails of people being like, oh, you know, I'm going to start a satellite in California. I'm going to get one going in Maine. You know, people just immediately. Right. And that's totally because of the Women's March.
Yeah. And so do you expect other marches around the country, just like in the Women's March, to spontaneously show
Definitely.
Up in other cities?
They've all, I mean, it's spontaneously happened, but we have a man named Kishore who's helping us kind of coordinate all of the satellite marches. And so we're calling them satellite marches because we're science nerds. Yeah. And is helping us coordinate them. And they're really just happening everywhere. And people are so unbelievably enthusiastic. It's been really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're careful to call this a nonpartisan mm-hmm. event. Why? What do you mean by that?
Because science is nonpartisan. I mean, science is about getting to the truth. It doesn't matter which side of the aisle someone is on or what they're focused mm-hmm. on. All that matters is whether or not they kind of appreciate evidence-based research. And, you know, a lot of people like to say that it is kind of, there's a lot of blame placed on Republicans for being anti-science, but the truth is that there are a lot of Democrats who are anti-science too. And by focusing on one party, you're letting the other one off the hook. And all that matters is that the person believes in science. It doesn't matter which side of the aisle they come from.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to get involved, the best way to do that is what?
Get involved in the march.
Yes.
Is to follow on Facebook or Twitter, because those are the best way that we push out information. We have a website, which is marchforscience.com, and there's a lot of information on the march, and we're going to shortly be putting up the details on all of the sister marches. So, mm-hmm. And then people are just volunteering to support advocacy and to get out into the communities and talk about science, and that's really what we're all about.
And where will the march, will it focus on the mall again, like other marches?
So there's going to be a march to the mall, but the main focus in D.C. is actually going to be a rally on the mall, which we're doing in partnership with the Earth Day Network, and they had this really cool idea to have it basically be a teach-in. So there are going to be tents set up all along the mall. And there will be a main stage where people talk, like, you know, the main stage speakers. But then in the tents are going to be scientists who talk about their work and their research and help people, you know, become invested in what they're doing and understand how their research affects their everyday life.
Is there going to be a single famous spokesperson who's going to be the key person in this? Or is it just like in the Women's March, there were just a lot of people?
I mean, there will definitely be people involved who are names that people will recognize. But we're... You know, it's important that there are so many branches of science and all of them deserve attention. You know, there are a lot of famous, like, medical researchers, mm-hmm. but there probably aren't as many familiar names of, like, botanists and geologists. But that's also a really important part of science. So we want to go kind of across the spectrum. So we're focused more on that than mm-hmm. having kind of one big.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's the date again is...
Is April 22nd.
It's a Saturday, Earth Day.
Yes, Saturday.
Obviously, people will be buses and things and people.
Everything's going to be organized and we're going to put all the information out there to help.
Start booking your hotel room
now. Yeah, seriously. We got to get on that for ourselves.
Got to get on that. Carol Weinberg, science writer and co-organizer of the March on Science, which is scheduled to take place Saturday, April 22nd, Earth Day in Washington and various satellite cities
around the world. Yeah.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And now we're going to move on to something totally different. We all know the moon to be an airless and hospitable place, but in this case, airless does not mean without oxygen. The samples from the Apollo missions have confirmed the presence of oxygen in the moon's soil. And while the easiest explanation may identify the source as the flow of particles from the solar wind, Japanese researchers think there's evidence that the Earth is also donating some of its own oxygen. Don't worry, it's just a small little bit of oxygen. And writing in Nature Astronomy this week, the researchers describe a change in the kind of oxygen that seems to be arriving on the moon, right when the Earth is in the prime position to be the culprit. It's where most of the oxygen when it's coming. Kevin McKeegan is professor of geochemistry and cosmochemistry, University of California in Los Angeles. He was not part of this study we're discussing, but he's able to talk about it. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Now,
it's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. You know, we think of the moon usually as dead and airless. Where is all this oxygen lurking?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The fact that the moon is airless is a really key part of this, because it's exposed. The grains that are on the surface of the moon are exposed directly to space. So anything that is impinging on the moon can get trapped in the surfaces of these grains. Whereas, of course, on the Earth, we have this protective layer of our atmosphere that keeps us safe from the bombardments of space.
So it's coming from the solar wind, or it just happens? Where is it? What makes you think, and what does the new research show, that it's getting sucked off of Earth?
Well, the new research is fascinating because it's based on a discovery from a Japanese spacecraft which could directly correlate a flow of oxygen ions toward the moon when the position of the spacecraft and the moon were such that they were traveling through the magnetic tail of the Earth. So the tail of the Earth's magnetic field, and therefore concentrating this flow of oxygen onto the surface of the moon.
Did this oxygen have a special signature to it that you know it's not coming from the solar wind, for example?
Yes, in the case of these measurements, they're able to determine the energy distribution of the oxygen ions and also their charge state. So it turns out that the sun, oxygen is the third most abundant element in the sun, and there is a wind that comes off the sun containing oxygen. But that oxygen is ionized several times over, so it's at a very high charge state, plus 5 or plus 6 or so. Whereas this oxygen that was detected only at certain times of the month, when the moon was passing through the Earth's magnetic field, this oxygen is only ionized once, and it's at a lower energy. And therefore, they could correlate this with what would be expected to be coming off the upper atmosphere of the Earth.
And so how much oxygen are we talking about that the Earth is losing to the moon?
Well, it's a very small amount, actually. When you put it in terms of number of atoms, it sounds like a great deal. They detect something like 30,000 ions per square centimeter per second, so it sounds like a lot. But in terms of the accumulated mass, it's not very much, and it's in terms of the amount of oxygen that the Earth would have lost, because presumably this kind of thing has been going on for billions of years, it's still not very much. We're not going to run out of oxygen.
Good to know. This is PRI, Public Radio International. So what happens to the oxygen when it gets to the moon? Does it get sucked up someplace?
Well, these are ions, and they have enough energy, so if they encounter a solid material like a mineral grain sitting on the surface of the moon, they will hit that and get implanted slightly below the surface in the crystalline lattice of the mineral grain. And here is where the group wants to make an intriguing but still somewhat speculative connection to previous measurements that were made on lunar samples, lunar soils brought back by the Apollo astronauts. So because the moon is generally so poor in oxygen, there is some metal grains, iron metal grains that can exist on the surface of the moon. Whereas, of course, if you have a small grain of metal on the Earth, it will be rusted away very, very quickly. But that doesn't happen on the moon. And on the other hand, it's been known now for some time that these grains can be have some oxygen implanted into their surface. And the source of that oxygen has been, I would say, somewhat mysterious or not very well understood. Certainly, you mentioned earlier the solar wind. And so the solar wind is striking the surface of the moon all the time. And it was initially thought that maybe some of this oxygen that was detected in the surface of these metal grains could come from the solar wind, but we now know that that's not the case.
Yeah. Could the lunar oxygen tell us more about the Earth?
That's the really exciting thing about this study, and the provocative thing almost, is that this presents a possibility for the preservation of Earth's atmosphere in grains that had been on the surface of the moon. And so this is part of a more general point that's really an important aspect of studying the moon is that, you know, what happened to the moon happened to the Earth. And it's all, and now it's taken an even step further, saying that material from the Earth could be preserved on the moon. And especially gases, right, which wouldn't stick around on the Earth for very long before getting mixed up. So that's really a new, something new and something very exciting.
You make a, it sounds like you're making a good case for revisiting the moon with, you know, with a new set of eyes, so to speak.
I think that would be fascinating. There, you know, we've only made the very initial forays into understanding our nearest neighbor in space, and there's really many compelling scientific reasons for going back to the moon and studying it, in part as a kind of witness plate for what happened on the Earth, and then also in part because it's possible that ancient Earth materials are actually preserved on the moon. So here we have an example of modern atmosphere, but as I said, this kind of thing has been going on for geologic history. The moon used to be closer to the Earth, and there's some really intriguing possibilities there.
Well, I'm ready to go back. Yeah.
Good. Yeah, me too. I'll go with you.
All right. Now, it seems, you know, we hear there are private companies that want to go to the moon and maybe mine it, and, you know.
That's a little bit outside my field of expertise, and that raises a whole lot of other interesting questions. And I'm sure at the time that lawyers will find some ways to get involved and make some money.
Well, Dr. McKeegan, I think you're the first guy named a cosmochemist we've ever had on the show.
Hey, so. Happy to come back anytime, Ira, and talk about cosmochemistry.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Kevin McKeegan is UCLA professor of geochemistry and cosmochemistry in Los Angeles. Thank you for, and have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
That's about all the time we have. Just one last thing. Last week on the show, we talked about an algorithm to fight online extremism. We said Facebook didn't get back to us. They did. They got back to us, and they said they're partnering with Microsoft, Twitter, and YouTube on this issue. And you can find a link to their announcement on our website. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. We are thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And please, you can write us always at sciencefriday.com. And we're up tweeting and we're on Facebook. If you like us, please like us on Facebook. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.